Welcome back to Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650. We are broadcasting live from the Kintech studio. It's Jamie Dodd, Thomas Trance here. 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line, Metro Vancouver's trusted choice for contractors and rental warriors for over 50 years. Visit them at one of their three locations to serve you or online at DunbarLumber.com. This hour of Canucks Talk is brought to you by Rack Steel. Rack Steel offers industry-leading heli forklifts and engineered racking solutions. Visit them online at racksteel.com. Harmon Dial from The Athletic going to join us in a moment here. Looking in to the inbox, Ryan in the Ridge says, is it too early to start the draft lottery simulator? Certainly not. Although, with where the Canucks are positioned, you're not going to get a lot of joy.
Might be too late.
Out of the draft lottery simulator. And it's going to be tough.
Well, if you can only move up how many spots?
Like 10, I believe.
Oh, okay. Right? That's pretty good.
Yeah, but I mean, what are the odds? I guess let's go to Tankathon right now and find out.
Hey, Jamie, never tell me the odds. Actually do it every day as part of a pre-planned segment.
You're the exact opposite of Han Solo in that regard.
100%.
C-3PO, constantly tell me the odds. Keep me updated. All right.
That Han Solo, I believe too short-sighted
the
and
Canucks
reckless.
Right now have a 0.5% chance to move up 10 spots.
Sorry?
A 0.5% chance to move up 10 spots. So there you go. One in every 200 clicks of the lottery.
So they're not going to do the Kessel Run in 12 parsecs?
Probably not. Anyways, right now joining us, as mentioned, from The Athletic covering the Canucks, he is Harmon Dial. Harm, what's going on, man?
Nothing much. I was just going to say, whether it's lottery odds or playoff odds at this point, they're about equivalent to my chances of dating Sydney Sweeney. Like, it ain't happening.
Don't sell yourself short, Harm.
Brother, dream big. The engagement just got called off.
Well, exactly. It's still like not 0.5, right?
You don't want to be in that. You don't want to be in that zone, though. Like, that's the worst spot to be in, where your chances of winning the lottery and your chances of making the playoffs are the same. Because that means they're both so low. That's like the worst spot to be in as an NHL team this time of year.
What did you call it, Harmon?
The sadness zone.
I feel like it's the Canucks zone. I feel like they own this.
Yeah, they might patent it if it continues for a few more years.
Calgary might have something to say about that historically. Calgary has lived a lot in this zone over the course of their life.
We should figure out who's made the most picks between 10 and 15 across the last 6 years, because I bet if you look at that and then look at the bottom of the standings, you will see a lot of like correlation. That's my guess.
Yeah.
What do you think, Carmen? Should we study this, build a spreadsheet?
It'd be really fun, honestly.
Which team has spent, I think, but you stretch back, I would go back like 25 years. Who's been in the sadness zone the most in the last 25 years. Yeah. My bet off the top of my head is Calgary, but we'll see.
Yeah,
I mean,
Calgary or Vancouver, Western Canada, misery
represent
loves company. Harmon, where do we go from here? Like, where do we go from here? Give me your top three off-season priorities that you think the Canucks sort of need to nail so that we're not having these conversations about the sadness zone 12 months from now.
Yeah, I mean, the elephant in the room is obviously addressing the center situation, and it's not going to be easy. Like, we know this team needs another top six center. And yet when I look around at the free agent market, when I look at realistic, trade options, there aren't a lot of, attractive options that make sense. So right off the bat, you're going to have to nail that. And it's by far going to be their toughest, sort of box to check off there.
Yeah.
Beyond that, I mean, I also think you have to nail what you're going to do in net next season. And that sort of comes down to, what exactly are you going to do with Thatcher Demko? Are you comfortable as the Canucks committing $9.5 million to Lankanen and Demko next season? Or because of his injury history and because this team doesn't actually have a ton of cap flexibility to add like multiple, like two or three top flight forwards, you look at that $5 million cap and then go, we are better off reallocating that elsewhere to try and upgrade the forward group. So like nailing the future net, and especially, this is the other part too, if you do decide to move on from Demko, then it's also, it can't just be Lankinen. You're going to have to find another steady, you know, second goaltender, because clearly Lankinen can't play like 50, 55 games on his own. We've seen down the stretch that it's impacted his performance. And we know the free agent market isn't the best either. So nailing the goaltending situation and what you're going to do with Thatcher Demko's future stands out. And then beyond that, it's just they need more impact sort of difference makers at the top of the lineup up front, whether it's at center, whether it's on the wing. This blue line looks pretty solid at this stage. The team's improvement in non-Quinn Hughes minutes with the second and third pair has been really noticeable since they, you know, made those series of trades and call-ups. But we know that this group just lacks venom in the top six. You only have two forwards on the roster right now, in Elias Pettersson and Brock Besser, who've had a single 60-point season in their NHL careers. And Besser, of course, is a UFA. So as of now, under contract for next season, you only have one forward on your roster who's had a 60-point season, and Pettersson is a guy that we don't even know if management is fully sold on keeping him for next year. So this team needs a lot more offensive skill up front, even beyond just the one high-end center that we've been talking about.
Now, one potential in-house option, Nils Höglander, and, you know, if we had been talking about that 3 months ago, I think a lot of people would have scoffed at the idea that he could be part of the solution in the top six. Still might be a long shot, but, you know, I know you were highlighting in your latest piece at The Athletic on yesterday's game just how effective he's been over the last few months for the Canucks, and considering how his season has gone, I thought it was really notable that Rick Tocchet, after the game yesterday, was saying, hey, look, a lot of people could learn from Hoggy and what he's doing here. What do you think is kind of a realistic expectation for him next season? And I guess more importantly than that, how should the Canucks internally be viewing Höglander? Should they be seeing him as, hey, this guy could potentially be a top six fit for us, someone who could really help in that regard? Or should they still be seeing him as an option further down the lineup?
Yeah, I'd hesitate to have full confidence that you can lean on him as a full-time top six option. But somewhere in your top nine and in ensuring that you give him a consistent opportunity in the top six, yeah, like that's how the Canucks should view him at this point, because even last night, right, it's one thing to, like, for a while he'd been driving play further down the lineup, but to do it last night on a line that primarily went up against the Jack Eichel line, especially through the first two periods, they more than held their own. They looked fast. They looked well-connected. Höglander was driving controlled entries. He obviously scored really early in that first period. I see the traits for him to be an effective full-time top nine forward for this team moving forward. And it's important that he's having this success down the stretch, because even big picture, when you look at the way this Canucks roster is constructed, even when you have this sort of decision coming up with Pia Suter, the club has you know, quite a bit of money committed to forwards who you sort of look at as maybe like middle six tweeners that aren't really full-time top six guys, right? So you've got 3.25 committed to Joshua, nearly 4.5 committed to Hedl, 3 million for Höglander. And now we're talking about, if you want to keep Suter, like that's going to be a significant cost too. Like that's a lot of money committed to sort of middle lineup guys. And if Höglander had struggled down the stretch, then I wonder if management would have looked at him as a piece that, hey, we've got too much money committed to guys that aren't true full-time top six contributors. And so therefore, do we look at, you know, moving one of these guys to free up some cap space? That's why his performance down the stretch matters. And I've long been a believer in his skill set. And to me, considering how much this team struggles to, you know, drive offense and create up front, at 5-on-5, I think they really need Höglander's skill set next season.
So, Harmon, you know, you've followed a lot of Canucks seasons that have kind of ended in similar fashion to this one. And the long list of, like, young players playing roles at this time of year, right? That sort of meaningless minutes at this time of year, and then the market getting excited, right? Let's call this, yeah, like a Kito Hirose factor. Right?
Yeah.
So what I want to do is I want to give you a bunch of names, okay? And then I want you to power rank their potential to avoid being like Akito Hirose footnotes. Guys, the market gets excited. The like Jack Rathbone, Brendan Gaunce tier guys.
Yeah.
We're basically rating like from real, right? Real contributor, real potential, all the way to the sort of bottom end where it's like, yeah, maybe we'll see. I'm going to give you the following names. Ready? Linus Karlsson.
Specifically for next season?
Let's go for next season. Let's go for next season. Yeah. So not overall. You can caption it as we go. So we'll do Linus Karlsson, already extended. We'll do Max Sisson. We'll do Atu Ratu. Okay. Let's do Elias Pettersson, the defender. Let's do Victor Mancini. So those five. Is there anyone else who should be? Lekkerimäki. Let's do Lekkerimäki as well, even though he didn't play last year. So that's the six. Karlsson, Sisson, Ratu, Lekkerimäki, Pettersson, Mancini.
Okay. I'll start from the bottom.
Okay.
Just because I want to eliminate a couple guys. Sisson, he's been a good story, but I like other guys better. I'm going to go Mancini.
So you're putting Mancini pretty low. I think you're lower on Mancini than the market would be at this point. Can you get into why?
Yeah, I think he's shown that he can hang if he's, really sheltered as number 60 man. But I thought the seams have shown over this weekend when he's been sort of elevated into this higher leverage role playing with Quinn. And to me, it's easy to fall in love. And then honestly, like I think I fell into this through the first few games as well, into the physical profile of how well he moves, how like his size, the occasional flashes offensively. But I think what I've learned recently is there's a lot of work for him to do when it comes to processing the game at an NHL level, and specifically when it comes to making reads and positioning. I thought he had, several shaky moments last game, just situations where, for first period off an offensive zone draw, Vegas wins it, he's diving into the neutral zone and it leads to a 3-on-1 chance against slot coverage, including on three on two or the 3-2 game winner that Vegas scored. But even there was another scoring chance in the second period where I didn't love the slot coverage. I just feel like he could give you depth minutes next year, but my expectations are tempered, especially because like I've seen like the Rathbone, the Hirose effect before. And so that's why I'm a little bit lower on Mancini right now, even though he made a pretty solid first impression. After that, I would say, who do I have left?
You have Karlsson. Yep. You have Ratu.
I actually really like Karlsson's game. I think he has the lowest ceiling out of Ratu, Lekkerimäki, and Karlsson for next season. But his floor is pretty high. I think he's become a little bit quicker, which makes an impact. And even just the play, the assist that he had on Saturday in the Ducks game, I've really liked his play below the hash marks. I think he should absolutely be in the conversation for making this team as a depth forward out of camp. Second, I think it's a toss-up right now between Ratu and Lekkerimäki. Ratu's looked more NHL ready, and we know that he has an edge as somebody who can play center and the face-offs element, and obviously scoring. But for me with Lekkerimäki, I know he's kind of faded a little bit since the breakout game he had against New Jersey, but I just look at a player like that, and given how young he is and how much he tore up the AHL this year, I just wouldn't be surprised if he takes a big step in the summer and looks like a different player in training camp. If I had to just rank them right now, though, I'd probably have Ratu ahead of Lekkerimäki.
Interesting. So you'd have Ratu kind of as to the top of that list of guys potentially to like make an impact next season.
Yeah, I've been impressed, and especially given that this team, doesn't have a lot of skill at center, I've liked his knack for getting open on the inside as a bigger body, and I did a couple chances even outside of the goal that he scored where just off the wall, they were able to work the puck to Ratu in the slot, and he generated some chances. Yeah, I've liked his game, and look, there is still room to improve. Absolutely, I think when you look at his underlying numbers over, you know, the last seven games that he's played, that line has created a lot offensively, but they've also given up a lot defensively. So there is still work to be done. But I just look at him as, you know, big body. He's already good on draws. I think he's got pretty good IQ. He can win battles. And because he would require waivers to get sent down next season, I think that increases the likelihood of him making the roster next season, just even from a protecting the asset standpoint.
And just before we let you go, Harm, five games remaining in the season now for the Canucks. And again, you know, we all know where this is going for the playoffs. What do you want to see? What should be the organization's number one priority in these final five games?
For me, I just want to see Thatcher Demko play well, stay healthy down the stretch. I think that would be huge for his confidence in turning the page on what's been a really difficult season for him with injuries. Yeah, I mean, we know that over his last several starts overall, he's been able to sort of pick things back up. The Seattle game notwithstanding, that being the exception. I think it matters for him. We've talked a lot about the young guys, but among the veterans, it's important in my mind for him to finish strong, finish healthy, heading into the summer. Even from let's say there's a scenario where the Canucks look at Demko and want to monetize him, even from a trade value perspective, I think teams would probably feel at least a little bit more comfortable if he continues his strong play down the stretch, as opposed to you know, if God forbid he gets hurt again, right? So keeping my eye on Demko down the stretch.
Harm, always appreciate the time. Thanks for doing this. We'll chat again in a couple of weeks.
Thanks, guys.
That is Harmon Dial from The Athletic covering the Canucks and weighing in on the performances of some of the young players down the stretch here. And, you know, we did have a text come in, and which I thought was an interesting point, asking, it was from Sepp in Vancouver, who says, Mancini has been playing significantly more minutes than DPD. Having trouble understanding this. How would you compare their recent play and development trajectory? It is interesting. I wonder how much of this comes down to just the left shot, right shot thing, and they have DPD right now playing on his offside along with Derek Forbort, and if that just fundamentally limits his minutes. But Mancini has gotten a big opportunity to play with Quinn Hughes. It hasn't necessarily gone very well, but I guess if you're playing with Quinn Hughes, you're going to play a lot more minutes. But based on their performances, if it was just a pure merit system for who's getting more minutes, you would think DPD would be getting the better time on ice right now.
Look, the Canucks were after value in a bad situation more than anything else when they traded JT Miller to the New York Rangers for Hedl, Mancini, and the first, which they quickly flipped for Marcus Pettersson and Drew O'Connor. You know, it's been a long time. Again, I think you have to go back to Bourdon Edler for the last time that the Canucks had like enough surplus of young defenders where you could actually realistically see a path to the team leveraging that surplus to help put together the sort of package required to land the kind of upside forward, right? I'm not saying it's a showcase, but I do wonder a little bit. You know, playing with Hughes, at least trialing it, seeing sort of what it looks like, right? Because if you have a bunch of defenders, if you believe in the players you have, you know, and you think your needs at forward are critical, well, all of Mancini, Volander, and we talk a lot about
DPD.
We talk a lot about how Elias Pettersson's move clause kicks in July 1s. Who else's does?
Who?
Filip Peronik.
Oh, all right. Let's add him to the list.
Well, I'm just saying, if you're looking at him with Pettersson, with Hughes, right? Do we have a potential answer here?
Mm-hmm.
If you're getting a real look at that, which they clearly are.
Absolutely.
Right? Like, that's the reason that he's playing these minutes. They want to take a real look. Can you do this? Now, there's hockey reasons for that. If you can, then we can play Hronek down lineup. Then we can play potentially Volander down lineup. But also, if you can, does that create an environment where Volander can land us the top forward we need? Does that create the environment where Hronek can land the top forward you need plus?
Right? Plus something else, yeah.
Because, I mean, that his value has spiked significantly given sort of how he's performed as a top of the lineup piece relative to where his value was when the Canucks acquired him. I'm not saying, you know, again, I wouldn't call it a showcase, but I do sort of wonder, is this a fact-finding mission?
Yeah.
As the club, you know, I think
realistically, which is what they should be using these games for, is finding out stuff like 100%. This, giving this stuff a look. And it puts it on tape for other teams, and it gives you information.
Yeah. And look, I don't know that the club would consider dealing Filip Hronek. I suspect they would not. I don't think the club would consider dealing Tom Volander. They certainly haven't considered it in previous positions where they might, right? Like at the deadline last year as the number one team in the West. But having a sense of sort of the stores, what you have to barter with, I think is crucial given the scale of Vancouver's hunting operation this offseason.
All right, up next, we will go back to discussing the big NHL news from the weekend. Alex Ovechkin breaking Wayne Gretzky's career regular season goals record. Sean Gentile, he was on the scene yesterday for the big moment, the ceremony, and all of it. We'll get his thoughts on the moment, what it means for the NHL, Ovechkin's legacy, all that next here with Sean Gentile of The Athletic on Canucks Talk, Sportsnet 650. What are we doing here, fellas?
Right stream music.
It's true.
They didn't say we couldn't play it.
Just wait until the Beethoven estate gets
this
on our asses.
This is my favorite part. Hold on.
I mean, this is a fire track.
Look, I mean, what are you going to say? he cooked with this one. There's no doubt about it. He was cooking.
You remember that famous TikTok? They're like, oh, boy. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
So good.
Remember when last year they found a hidden Beethoven track and it was like, we got a new Beethoven track before GTA 6?
I love that you call it a track, a Beethoven track, unreleased. We found the masters for this new Beethoven track.
It's a B-side, and the B is for Beethoven.
It's like an unused beat. No one ever rapped over it. Here you go. It's out there now. Well, shout out to Beethoven. Did some great work. All right, it is Canucks Talk here, Sportsnet 650. We're broadcasting live from the Kintec studio. Kintec Footwear and Orthotics working together with you in step 650. 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Now joining us from The Athletic, as mentioned, he was in Long Island for the big moment with Alex Ovechkin yesterday. He's our guy, Sean Gentile. Sean, what's going on, man?
So you guys are going to play me into like the Fifth Symphony Ludwig version.
Yeah.
He got control of his masters back. He's re-recording everything to up those stream counts.
Ludwig's version of Beethoven's Fifth.
Yeah, exactly.
By the way, Drance thought that was Beethoven's Ninth, by the way.
Yeah, I messed it up.
I'm outing him here.
And then
pretends to be this highfalutin, educated, cultured guy, and then it's just dropping facts like that.
Jamie looked at me and called me an uncultured swine and then said, the Ninth is Ode to Joy. And I was like, immediately thinking about how I could crush that on the recorder.
Ode to Joy, you fool.
Yeah.
You plebe. Let's go.
I should have known that the Ninth was...
All right. Let's get this back on track.
Admit it. That was a good impression of a recorder.
Fantastic. Sean, you were on the ground there in person for one of the biggest NHL moments in a long time, really. I was saying earlier in the show, this is kind of a once every 30 years thing that the all-time goals record gets broken, and an incredible scene. I mean, I'm sure most of our listeners were watching it happen yesterday. What was it like to be there in the building for it?
Oh man, it's one of those things where like you try not to feel like the prisoner of the moment there, but it did. It felt big and it felt important. And you know, I thought the NHL ceremony was pretty solid. I thought they kind of rose to the occasion and gave it, you know, some degree of heft that it deserved. So yeah, I don't know. It was all good. You know, it's a perfect Ovechkin goal. Perfect Ovechkin celebration. And then we get to see, you know, more more Gretzky's like stand-up bits too, because he's been trying to make jokes pretty consistently over the last week or so when he's been doing these media avails. So we got some more of that too. I think everything struck, you know, a pretty solid tone. And I came out of there feeling like I watched history, and I think that's about the most you could expect.
Why is Ovechkin so cool? I don't know why I find him such a riveting. Well, I sort of have an idea. It's just because he's so original and uncompromising about his game and has been across 20 years. But why is he so cool, Sean?
It's a good question. Is it now how much of it has to do with like eating Cheetos on the on the team plane and
a lot,
you know, playing volleyball during the off season, looking like an absolute fridge out there. Like I think that's turned into like part of the Ovechkin legend as he's like segued fully into old man mode. Like that's really fun, and there's something endearing about that. And it's funny too, because guys, like we're of an age now where we watched him when he was young, and we're watching him when he's old, and he's basically in our same age group. Like I went to the University of Maryland right outside DC when he was a rookie. You know, I mean, we've watched his game change, and we've watched his hair go gray and all that stuff. And I think that makes him particularly endearing to maybe folks who are like in our age bracket too,
well,
specifically.
And it's interesting because when he came into the league, you know, such an exciting young talent, but also kind of that classic hockey thing where it was like, he's not real, you know, does he take himself seriously enough? Can you win with him? Does he play defense? Like all this, like, you know, trying to fit him into the more traditional hockey way of being. Whereas now he almost seems like a bit of a throwback, right? As you said, like, it doesn't take not obsessed with his diet necessarily or his offseason workouts, right? Just kind of going out there, having fun, playing instinctually. It's interesting that he's kind of been able to bridge from, you know, young firebrand who people are questioning. And then now he's kind of this throwback figure that reminds you of days gone by in a different NHL.
Absolutely, man. And it's funny, you know, when you watch old videos of him too, you know, you watch the goal that he scored against Arizona when he was a rookie, and he's sliding on his back. And, you know, Gretzky was the coach of that team. You watch that. It's like, it's funny because it seems like a different person in some regards, but also like there's moments where you're like, oh yeah, it's actually more of a progression. You know what I mean? This is like, it's interesting to me that this is the version of Ovechkin that we're getting 20 years later. And I think we're all just looking for, and another thing, like we're looking for precedent here, I think, in some ways, and there is none, right? Like nobody's game has aged like his. He's scoring more goals per 60 now than he has at any point in his career, which is just incredible. Mm-hmm. So I think there's a lot of just his overall existence, I think, raises a lot of questions about like aging curves and all that sort of stuff. And it's impossible not to think about all that as we've watched him over the last few weeks, because he really is, man. This is like, I mean, the dude's scoring goals at a 55 goal pace this season.
Yeah.
You know, like how, like what? And he's 39, and again, he's chubby and has a full head of gray hair and all this. Like we're trying to like reconcile all that with what we're seeing. It's kind of wild.
Yeah, 42 goals in 61 games this year. Of course, he missed time with a broken leg,
and he looked.
Yeah.
And he looked like, you know, when you see Cristiano Ronaldo now play for like Portugal and like top level competition, and it's like, yeah, he can still like do damage, but he definitely is like a liability on the press. His first 10 games back from that broken leg before the Four Nations break, he looked like that guy. Like I was like, oh man, this might be a joyless slog, him getting to the record now. And I don't know what he did. Well, I know he went to Miami, didn't go back to Russia during the break, but he looks like he did earlier in the year. Like it clearly he took this exceptionally seriously and is delivering.
Yeah, and I think Spencer Carberry deserves a lot of credit for this too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, going back really in both of the seasons that he's coached Ovechkin, that dude is a high end NHL coach. I think he knows how to use him. I think he knows how to maximize the stuff that he's still great at. And I think he's done basically, I know they're in the tank right now a little bit. They've lost, I think, 4-6. So it's maybe not the best time to have this discussion, but it is true overall. in terms of the long arc of Ovechkin's last two seasons, I think he really benefits from having a coach who who understands, I think, his game at this point in his career, and has really found a way to blend the record chase stuff with, you know, the overall goal, which is to win as many hockey games as possible. So yeah, I think he benefits from that too.
Yeah, the team success element of it is really interesting, because look, you know, no matter the circumstances where the record got broken, it would still be a big deal. It'd be an exciting moment for hockey. But I mean, to draw the obvious comparison to a situation close to you, Sean, if you flipped the position of the Penguins and the Capitals in the standings, and you know the Capitals have long since been eliminated from playoff contention, and he's breaking it in that situation, again, still an incredible moment, but it has a bit of a different feel. The fact that he's doing it, having an incredible season individually, you know, it's not like he had to play one final year where he scored 15 goals to limp across the finish line or anything. And this team that's almost completely been refreshed since their Stanley Cup team is in contention for the President's Trophy. It just great. Like, it doesn't feel like a sideshow at all, because it's no, he's still a great player, and this is a great team that we're following doing this.
Yeah. And also, you know, they've essentially locked up the top seed in the Eastern Conference, and they're still in the President's mm-hmm. Trophy race, like right there with Winnipeg and Dallas. So like, they've been able to. It's not that big of a deal if they lose these games, right? Like it's just not like you'd rather see Logan Thompson healthy and you know and all that sort of stuff. But I think the cushion that they've built for themselves, it's allowed those other guys to enjoy the moment as well. You know, like Dylan Strome was running around like a little kid all week long. And I think if they were, you know, grinding it out for a wild card spot and losing these games, things would be different. And certainly if they were in a position like the Pittsburgh Penguins, where they're just, you know, whatever,
trying tank,
playing out the string, then things would be different too. But I think that, you know, collision of factors absolutely, you know, has helped make the chase a little bit more gratifying than it would have been otherwise.
Yeah, and I thought Ryan Leonard getting his first NHL goal, that was like incredibly endearing. I found the symbolism of that in that game against Chicago.
He's great, by the way. Like we're gonna enjoy the Ryan Leonard era as it relates to post-game quotes. And
what a way to enter the NHL in the midst of this.
Smart and really funny.
With Gretzky following your team around and the commissioner, like what a way to begin your NHL career.
He was just super funny the whole time, just like very flatly being like, I can't believe this has happened to me. I don't know what's going on. I am freaked out by this. And it was pretty funny. Yeah.
So pivoting a little bit here, Sean, I mean, the Canucks not officially mathematically eliminated, could happen as early as tomorrow if they drop their game in Dallas against the Stars. I mean, we've kind of known where this is going for a little bit here. They're going to miss the playoffs after a really successful season last year. How do you look at the Canucks season in total now? Do you just chalk it up to like, hey, everything went wrong, injuries, or are there much bigger issues that this kind of revealed that the team needs to address?
It's tough to feel all that good about it, mainly because of Pettersson. Like I know that's just such a cliche at this point, but just I would feel a whole lot better about, you know, the direction that things are going with him in general if the season wasn't that much of a disaster for him specifically. I think what's gone on with him, you know, especially a couple months ago, I don't know. I feel like it's thrown a little bit of a pall over the whole thing, and it makes it tougher to just be like, all right, yeah, bad luck season, you know, whatever. Like that's, I don't know if that's quite good enough. They need him to, this is the understatement of the century, but it's like they need him to get it together. And I think the fact, you know, he basically hasn't is a major, major mitigating factor there.
Yeah. The thing I can't reconcile myself to just yet, Gentile, is, you know, we'll sort of see how the offseason looks, and that'll obviously inform how we talk about this team going into next season and on. But I just kind of look around the West and not just at like the fact that it's not, you know, the veteran Blues guys we're familiar with. Mm-hmm. Like it's not Braden Schenn and co driving this sort of renewal. It's Zachary Bolduc and Jake Nabors, right? Like, I sort of look at that and just think, like, what? How much do the Canucks need to accomplish before I'm picking them ahead of the Blues next year, right? The Wild are about to get all this cap space. Utah looked like they took a pretty significant step over the course of the year, even if they fell short. Even, like, the Anaheim Ducks are going to improve by 20-plus points. I just sort of look at the West and think, man, I feel like Vancouver's path's only going to get tougher here.
Absolutely. I think that's the risk that you run when you're, you know, in that spot where you're okay. You're like, oh, great, we're a solid wild card team, right? That's or whatever for like three seed, but comfortable wild card team. Yeah, you're in that spot until you're not. Like there's a lot of other teams kind of in that tier, and I think it definitely cuts the margin for error. And man, I'm foolish because I feel like I wrote off the Blues like three separate times this season.
Yeah,
like,
me too.
I don't know if I saw this coming, but then all of a sudden you're like, all right, like Robert Thomas, like Jordan Kyrou, they have like established solid players at the top of that lineup, and then the Jake Nabors's and the Jimmy Snuggerudes and all these guys that are that like Bolduc who you mentioned, like all these guys are coming up, and then all of a sudden it's like, okay, that's actually a pretty good core of players. It's not just Colton Parayko and Braden Schenn, like you said. And I think the fact that, you know, a team like that can leapfrog a team like the Canucks like so quickly is, you know, it doesn't bode well for sure. and it's going to make for an interesting offseason.
Sean, our colleague Pierre LeBrun reporting some CBA extension talks underway. Between the PA and the NHL here. Have you begun to wrap your head around what we're about to get into in a world with regular cap growth and $115 million upper limit over the next few years, given sort of the stagnancy that we've kind of lived through and become used to covering over the past half decade?
No. I haven't. I've said so many times, like anytime a deal's been signed for the last whatever 6 months, I and if I want to slant, like Jacob Chychrun, great example, like he signed for, you know, $8 million a year in Washington or whatever it was, and you look at that and you're like, oh my god, like that is what an overpay, right? Like Jacob Chychrun, he's talented but not perfect, and like, oh, he's gonna make $8 million a year for the next 7 years or whatever. But that is it, and who knows, maybe it does turn out to be an overpay, but like we have to recalibrate how we value players and how we discuss contract extensions in a very, very real way, because we didn't have to for so long, Drancer. Like you said, it for years and years and years we basically have known what a $6 million player looks like, or an $8 million player, or a league minimum player. Like we have these, you know, very data-backed ideas, I think, about player valuation, and we're gonna have to adjust them, because this is a very real, very serious change, and it's something that we haven't really had to reckon with in quite a while.
Sean, really appreciate the time, man. Happy to have you on, especially after witnessing that moment in Long Island yesterday. Thank you so much for doing this, and I'm sure we'll chat again soon with the playoffs coming up here.
Absolutely, boys. Sounds great.
That is Sean Gentile from The Athletic, and again, weighing in on what he witnessed as Ovechkin sets the NHL all-time goals record yesterday against the Islanders. Ends up in a 4-1 win for the Islanders, which is kind of funny as well, but... who cares? That's perfect, right? It's like it's not even like you have to be pretend to be sad about the result, because you're like, yeah, we're gonna be first in the East anyways. It doesn't matter.
Yeah, no,
you know,
no.
It's like whatever.
Yeah,
we
no,
got it done.
Zero performative anger. That video, by the way, of him walking into that like Greek restaurant to celebrate you know, the milestone, and the like hostess immediately walking up to him and giving him not one but two pops. You know, it's just like, we know he's going to want two pops in his hand the moment he walks through the door.
That's your job.
And it's like someone was literally there like, oh my God, this is my moment. And it's just like, that says everything about the guy. I love it so much, man. We should all be so lucky.
This text, I said earlier in the show, I feel like you could arrange for someone to hand you two beers. That's within your grasp.
No, but I have
I
to
think that you can make that happen.
Right here.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think you can make that happen.
First of all, I wouldn't drink beer at work.
Well, you can have zero alcohol beer at work.
Well, that's not the same.
But also, like, can you? Like, that's
still, yeah, why not?
That's still crazy.
You can have zero alcohol beer. It's like I have mouthwash in my backpack. It has alcohol.
You can have zero alcohol beer at any time, can't you? With zero alcohol. Why is it different from anything else?
I'm going to go ask Cam. One second.
I still think it's weird.
Why?
Well, first of all, there's still like 0.5% in it.
Okay.
Secondly,
what are you gonna
why
have?
Are you drinking beer at work?
100 of them?
I'm telling you right now, if I walked in and you were drinking beer before the show, like it was like a soda pop, I would think that was crazy.
Okay, it would be odd, but it wouldn't be like professionally inappropriate.
I think it would be a very weird look, yeah.
That would be weird. Of course it would be weird.
Because all of them look like beer cans. They have like, you know, they all look like beer. Yeah,
but just like the commercial, like Max Verstappen, you would just tap the side of the can and show that it's a 0-0.
Just like Max Verstappen.
Just like Max Verstappen.
We've all seen the commercial.
Be like Max.
Holding off the faster McLarens in Japan.
I'm just saying it might be like
the side of my beer.
It might like you're right. People would be like, that's an odd move.
I think it's antisocial.
But it wouldn't.
What? It's antisocial. If I walk into my place of work and I see you drinking beer and you have to tap the side of your can to be like, got away with it.
Got
it's
ya.
Like, you're crazy. Why are you doing that here? That's not professional and it's antisocial.
It's not. It's not unprofessional.
Unprofessional,
what if you just
antisocial,
really,
weird,
you just really like the taste of non-alcoholic beer?
Then drink it on your own time.
I don't get it. I don't get what your issue is.
What do you mean?
Where's the issue?
It's a weird thing to do.
What about de-alcoholized wine?
I want to be clear.
How do you feel about that?
It doesn't.
Grape juice. A glass of. No, you can get. You can get. You're right. It should just be grape juice.
I don't,
but you can get it.
I don't look at it as something that I'm like really
just
against.
A big oversized red wine glass.
Yeah. It's grape
decanter.
Juice. See,
to aerate my Welch's.
See, if I walked in and you were aerating your Welch's, I'd be like, that person's in like.
Well, that
wild.
Would be insane. Yes.
Yeah. The whole, but so would a drink. So would sitting at work drinking a non-alcoholic beer, man.
Sir, all could right. you stop aerating your Welch's?
You look like that rich white guy on Twitter, just like swirling his Welch's.
Oh man,
it's swirling your Welch's, just yeah. like. Have you heard that new sick track from Beethoven?
Okay, I was going to read a text from the inbox, but now we got distracted by that. So I'll take a break. Then I'll read a text from the inbox. Send your thoughts and questions in 650-650 to the Dunbar Lumber text line. We can look ahead to the Canucks offseason a little bit and read some texts of yours as well. That's next here on Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650.
Jamie looked at me and called me an uncultured swine and then said, the ninth is Ode to Joy. Immediately thinking about how I could crush that on the recorder.
Sportsnet 650, Vancouver.
It's over! It's over, ladies and gentlemen!
You put up the behind-the-scenes video of me calling Drans an uncultured swine, and also us lounging like complete goobers coming back from break, as stretched back in our chairs as it's possible to be. Speaking of a lack of professionalism, all we're missing is that zero-alcohol beer. Fresh in a cold one.
We looked like we were napping.
Yeah.
Waking up from a nap.
Things are going really well here. Welcome back.
So before we get into anything
all right.
else, I did an impression of someone playing Ode to Joy on a recorder, and then, of course, Arash found the drop of Ode to Joy being played on a recorder, and I asked him to cut them up back-to-back so I could test how good my impression was, because I'm not going to lie to you. I thought I was really good. I was really proud of it. So we're just going to quickly indulge me by listening to them both back-to-back, and then we'll move on with the show. I should have known that the ninth was
It's not bad. Well, shout out to Beethoven.
I think I nailed it. I'd say
that was good.
I'm going to give myself a 7 out of 10.
That was pretty good for an uncultured swine. You did pretty well there.
Uncultured swine.
This is one of our best shows.
By far.
I don't know. It is Canucks Talk here on Sportsnet 650. We're live from the Kintech studio. 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Metro Vancouver's trusted choice for contractors and rental warriors for over 50 years. Visit them at one of their three locations to serve you or online at DunbarLumber.com. Jampro, from showrooms to stockrooms and everything in between, Jampro keeps workplaces tidy, clean, and disinfected. For a free quote, visit jampro.ca. So 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. And just before we went to break in the last segment, Rocket in Langley texted in, Ovechkin went through what EP40 is going through at about the same age. Now, this was a topic of discussion on the morning show as well, making the comparison like, hey, a lot of people criticize Ovechkin, some ups and downs. I get where people are going. You look back at Ovechkin's career, though. Okay, so his worst goal-scoring rate season, 32 goals in 79 games at the age of 25. Now, that was a big dip because what he'd done in his previous seasons, 52, 46, 65, 56, 50. So going all the way down to 32, that's a big drop-off. However, he also had 85 points. He was, I'm pretty sure, top 10 in NHL scoring that year, and he led the league in shots on goal. So it was much more of a traditional down year for a player where it's like, well, you know, not quite his peak, and the shooting percentage was way down. That probably won't last, but he was still a really productive player, and again, led the league in shots on goal. 8.7 shooting percentage, the lowest of his career. The next season at 26, and that's the year where Bruce Boudreau is fired and Dale Hunter takes over, and 38 goals, now only 27 assists, so 65 points. So not great from an overall production standpoint relative to his standards, but 38 goals was fifth in the NHL that year. So it's true that he had that little blip, and then the next, by the way, after that, he led the league in scoring, and he ran the Walker Richard 4 years in a row after that. So,
well, yeah, but
a strong return to form.
So I think what happened, though, right, is Ovechkin came in as a completely unparalleled physical specimen. Rush, mm-hmm. goal scorer, power forward extraordinaire, right? We're talking 400-plus shots, 200-250 hits, mm-hmm. like 243 hits. He had 243 hits and 528 shots at the age of 23. Holy cow, man. That is
unreal.
That is force of nature type stuff. And I think what happened is fundamentally playing hockey like that, that's a young man's game.
Mm.
That's a young man's game. At some point, even by the age of 24, 25, you are not the most athletic hockey player we've ever seen, right? By the time you become 24, 25, there's some other guy. There's Steven Stamkos comes into the league, you know, when Ovechkin's 24, and Ovechkin's, you know, the shot volume guy, and Stamkos is like, I can score that
the
many goals.
The shot quality guy, yeah.
I can score that many goals on half the number of shots, bro.
Yeah.
You know, and that's the nature of the beast, evolve or die. And what happens? Bruce Boudreau gets replaced by Dale Hunter by Adam Oates. And where does Ovechkin sort of start to dine out? Why does he lead the league in goals scored? His first six seasons in the league, power play goal totals, 21, 16, 22, 19, 13, 7, 13, right? The next 5 years after that, 16, 24, 25, 19, 17,
yeah.
17, 18, like he was scoring 15 power play goals a year basically through his age 40 season. Like, my goodness, man. Ovechkin evolved. And that's the key part of this. He went from being this dynamic rush attacking power forward to being a stationary attacking ace. He evolved. He adapted.
My point is, though, that even like the lows, quote unquote,
were still high.
You know what I mean? It's like one. So you take the 2 years, right? His age 25 and 26 season, 32 goals the 1 year, but top 10 in scoring, and then 38 goals the next year. And that's his worst season points production wise relative to the rest of the NHL. But he was a top five goal scorer.
Well, I think the important thing here, though, but like that we got to remember is Elias Pettersson is not an Alex Ovechkin.
100%.
He never hit those highs. Like, even when we were talking about him as like a potential top five centerman, he never hit those highs.
But that's kind of my point, is that it's like Ovechkin was so good that even his down seasons, it was still like, yeah, but he was fifth in the NHL in goals. And it was still fair to be like, oh, how is he remodeling his game? Is he on the downslope? But he was like, the highs were so high that he could decline a little bit and still be that effective. I would just caution trying to draw that parallel, because and that's a huge part of it. What you're pointing out is just the fact that Elias Pettersson didn't have those incredible highs right out of the gate.
He wasn't Alex Ovechkin. He wasn't a surefire Hall of Fame player. He wasn't the most physically gifted power forward we've ever seen, who then maintained a level of consistency previously unheard of in the NHL across a 20-year period.
Mm-hmm.
He is 2 inches shorter and 50 pounds lighter, probably, at the age of 18, right? He didn't play in the NHL the first year he was eligible to do so. He won the Calder, but, you know, he won the Calder with what? Like 70 points? 66 points?
69, I think.
Ovechkin was 100-point player, 50-goal scorer the moment he stepped foot on an NHL sheet.
Yeah.
Ovechkin is a force of nature that I don't think is a fair point of departure for Pettersson. Like, I think the way... Here, let me give you one. How about Pierre-Luc Dubois?
Sure. Okay. Now, did Pierre-Luc Dubois hit the highs of Pettersson early in his career?
Not offensively.
Yeah.
But Pierre-Luc Dubois looked like a surefire Norris guy. Or, sorry, Selke guy. In that 1920 season, when he has 49 points in 70 games prior to the pandemic, he's 21 years old. And then he goes absolutely beast mode on the Toronto Maple Leafs in the playoffs. Like, it looked like he'd arrived as this, you know, absolute, stunning, physically assertive two-way center, right? And, you know, ends up sort of having an injury-plagued and bubble season, gets traded. 60 points with the Jets that first season, 63 points the second season, earns that big deal with L.A., 16 goals, 24 points, yep. 40 points. And he looked lost. Like, he looked like he couldn't keep up. He looked like he wasn't trying. He looked like he had no heartbeat. I was at the age of 25. How much older is Pettersson? 1 year older?
Mm-hmm.
Or is it... Are they
the same draft?
No. Pierre-Luc Dubois was in the Lion A draft.
He was in the 2016.
I think Dubois is
1 year older than Pettersson, yeah.
Okay. So, like, pretty similar timeline then. And what happened? He got traded. Change of scenery. Tapped back into it. He's back to being a 63-point guy. And... with his play style, like, don't be shocked if you're watching a playoff series and Dubois is wrecking people, right? Mm. Is like hitting to hurt, using those liberal cross checks to wear down opponents in the dirtiest areas of the ice, and probably coming up pretty big in a moment or two as a, you know, clutch playmaker, because that's kind of who Dubois is.
That might be, we've talked a lot about just kind of the unprecedented feeling with Elias Pettersson, and, you know, people point to Huberto, but the age thing doesn't really work.
I see. It's just not...
The Dubois thing might be the best comparison.
It's just not that unprecedented. I really do believe that. Like, it is rare, but it is not unprecedented. I think what we have to grapple with, right, is Pettersson's struggles have persisted for so long now, right,
mm-hmm.
that... we have to include it. We can't look at it and be like, this is what it was before. This is what it is now. Okay. He is what he is before. Right. You can't throw out a 100-game sample.
Yeah.
No more though than you should look at the 100-game sample and throw out what preceded it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the right way of doing this analysis is that before this 100-game stretch of mid hockey was upon us, we were looking at Pettersson and being like, okay, we're, you know, he's keeping company with, you know, some of the best players we've seen in the NHL over the last 25 years. But most of those players don't have slumps like this. This isn't a slump. This is something else, right? But there are guys who we've seen go from being just electric players to, you know, having some underwhelming campaigns. And one of the guys that I go to is Brad Richards,
mm-hmm.
right? 62 points at 20, 62 points at 21, 73 points, 79 points, 91 points, and wins the Stanley Cup. And I think he wins the Conn Smythe. Anyway. And yeah, who won the Conn Smythe for the Lightning?
I don't know.
It might have been Brad Richards.
Yeah.
Let's see. I'm so confident it is.
No. Oh, sorry.
Conn Smythe trophy in 2004.
Yeah.
So, sorry. He was a 79-point player, wins the Conn Smythe, lockout happens, comes back 91 points. At that point, he's 25, and it looks like he's legitimately one of the best centermen in the game. The next three seasons, 70 points, 62 points, 51 points, 48 points. And then he finds this late career renaissance in Dallas, 91 points, 77 points again at the age of 29 and 30. Like, for me, that's a more apt comparison at this point than a guy like Ovechkin. Right? Brad Richards was a great player who burned hot on a good team early in his career and then settled into like a decade-long stretch where he was a reliable but not difference-making, top-of-the-lineup capable center. Right? Like, yep. that to me, the other one that stands out is Claude Giroux. Right? With Claude Giroux, you have, you know, he's drafted in the middle of the first round, 27 points in his first full NHL season, 47 the next, 76 the next, and that's sort of when, you know, he's anointed the best player in the world after outdueling Sidney Crosby in that Brizgalov playoff series. You remember that crazy Philadelphia-Pittsburgh series? You remember what I'm talking about? 93 points at the age of 24. At that point, he looks like legitimately like a contender with the Crosbys and Ovechkins of the world. The next season, 48 points, but his point per game. Anyway, at 27, 28, 29, so a little bit older than Pedersen, but we're talking about a guy who's been point per game plus through his mid-20s. We get a 73-point season, a 67-point season, and a 58-point season. And then he spikes back up and has multiple seasons, 100-plus points, 85-plus points. You know, for me anyway, like what I take, I think the way we have to think about Pedersen, and this is both optimistic and pessimistic, is it's like he's probably better than the last 100 games that we've seen from him because the highs that he was hitting were so high. 40-goal, 100-point seasons, just like an ace two-way driver, a Selke winner, like a point-per-game guy who controlled play 5-on-5. Like, I'm not throwing all that out because he's been poor for 100 games. There's that level is still there. But maybe it's not as consistent, or maybe it's not as overwhelming, right? Maybe the Pedersen comps that we need to be looking at are less, you know, Marner and Braden Point and more Brad Richards and Claude Giroux, like guys who are still top of the lineup capable guys, but maybe not the transcendent superstars of their generation.
I think there's a definite point to be made there about how we should adjust what we're expecting from Elias Pedersen from this point forward. But I also find you go back and look at some of those examples. Like, I'm looking at the Claude Giroux one right now, right? 58 points in 82 games at his age 29 season, then has 102 points at his age 30 season next year. And it's like, okay, he doubled his shooting percentage from the down year to the up year. You know what I mean? He shot 7% in the first one, in the down one, and 17.6%. So more than doubled in the next one. His shot rate, he had 199 shots in 82 games when he scored 58 points, and then he had 193 shots the next year. So basically equivalent. And that's the thing for me with Pedersen is you can point to kind of a traditional thing there, right? Where it's like, wow, tough shooting luck with the 1 year, really good shooting luck the next year. And that doesn't account for all of it. I'm sure there's other, like, I'm sure he did just perform better in the really up season, but it at least accounts for some of it. And that's what I mean when I talk about the unprecedented feeling, is it feels like there's none of those traditional slump markers where it's like, ah, it's just bad luck. Where even in a case of Claude Giroux, and that's I think you're dead on, and that's a really good example because of the extreme splits from 1 year to the next, but you can still find more signs of what we typically associate with kind of a one-off down year from a superstar player.
Yeah.
And so that's what elevates the concern level a little bit for me with Pedersen.
Well, so since the All-Star break last year, okay, so 97 game stretch, this is basically when the Pedersen conversation really got hot.
Yeah.
179 shots, 22 goals, all situations. That's a 12.5% shooting clip over a pretty long segment of time. Now, why don't you talk for 2 seconds while I just do the math?
Because his career points percent or shooting percentage is 16.3 in all situations. And it's been like one of the things of Elias Pedersen is until this season, it's been extremely, extremely stable. Like, he has not really had a crazy shooting percentage spike year or shooting percentage slump year in his career, other than possibly his rookie season. He's at 19.4. But other than that, it's 16, 16, 16, 15, 16. He's always right in that range as a, you know, a guy who's been an elite finisher in his career. So it has gone down a little bit.
Yeah, so he was 16.4% career shooter until the last little stretch. So it actually hasn't even dented his... That can't be. I must be doing the math wrong.
I think you're probably right, because this year he just hasn't taken many shots to to lower it down.
But
that
it's
much,
still
you know?
13.8. My point being,
yeah, but it's like that's down a little bit.
It's not just that though. It's also that Pettersson was a huge outlier, like a Kucherov level outlier in terms of not just his efficiency as a personal shooter, but his team's efficiency with him on the ice, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's sort of the other part of this that you know I'm curious to look at. Yeah, his on-ice shooting percentage has also dipped. Not that significantly, though. It's hard to figure out. I think the truth is that I look at and watch him play, and it looks different. There's not the same level of deceptive skating.
Mm-hmm.
There's not the same level of speed. There's not the same level of juice. And, you know, I do buy as a result of that, and have been buying all season, that there must be some sort of injury component to it. Now, given that whatever happened last summer... Right, he didn't come back rejuvenated.
Mm-hmm.
Right, you know, he noted that the knee tendonitis was bothering him after the playoffs. Okay, he noted that it had impinged on his ability to prepare in the summer. He returned to camp and struggled again this season with it looking very, very similar in terms of, you know, it looking like he can't catch up. His brain's not catching up to what he wants to do, and almost like his confidence goes down after that.
Right.
But, you know, I'd add some elements to this, which is the team was clearly unsatisfied with his preparation. Reading between the lines, it seems his teammates might have not been super impressed by the level of preparation, right? So you sort of put it all together, and I think there's a ton of reasons for concern, but there's also... You know, something that I think we have to remain focused on, or at least continue to account for, which is that Pettersson is super, super talented. And even if we're living in a world where his speed doesn't come all the way back or what have you, right? I tend to prefer to bet on super talented people figuring out how to make it work as their circumstances change, as opposed to, you know, your average player. That said, 11.6, it's a lot. And, you know, that this has been a dispiriting performance from him over the course of the campaign, how he's carried himself, how he's performed, right? And so I don't think it's unfair to be on the Jason Brough side of the equation here. I'm not, because I still think he's a really, really good player. And I think there's a decent chance that if you trade him, he goes Pierre-Luc Dubois in next season.
That's the fascinating thing about the Pierre-Luc Dubois example, which I think is a really good one.
Yeah, it's like, could he have done this in LA?
Would he have done that in LA?
And
would
I don't
have
think
the turnaround?
So. I don't think so. I'll be honest with you.
Yeah. And so that's a, like, I don't want to come to that conclusion. And I'm not saying I'm there yet, but it's just interesting that I think Pierre-Luc Dubois might be the best comparison of all the ones we've listed here in this segment. And then the conclusion is he goes somewhere else and turns it around and gets back to that version of himself. You don't want that to be the ending here. You want to hope that you can create the conditions, whatever they are, for him to that turnaround and figure it out here.
You need to be able to. Like, I don't know how else to put this. Like, you know, at the end of the day, Pierre-Luc Dubois was acquired at significant expense by the LA Kings, and Vilardi would obviously look great in LA, and Rasmus Kupari is a favorite of mine. I really like his game, and Iafallo's been a useful player for the Jets. You know, they doubled down on their forward depth in losing Dubois, and I mean, that team's had two successful seasons as a result, right? Like, they won that trade from the perspective of where they're positioned now, even though Kemper's been good for LA and they managed to fix the mistake to some extent. But the truth is I still think Pettersson is a different caliber of player entirely than a player like 100%. Dubois.
His high was way higher than the high that
Dubois
was
hit. Yeah. And so, you know, I think the stakes are different, right? The Canucks need to figure out how to make it work with Pettersson, especially with where they're positioned.
It's a lot more harmful to punt on Pedersen than it was for the Kings to punt on Dubois.
And yet,
especially considering like they have Byfield coming, they still have Kopitar there, all those things.
Yeah, and you know, obviously this organization has struggled to partner with this player in a variety of different. That's taken on a variety of different iterations, but obviously he failed to partner with JT Miller. The organization struggled to foster an environment where they could partner effectively, you know, more than anything. And I think this is like the most important framing is to like put it in those workplace terms, especially because everything I hear behind the scenes is like, it wasn't as dramatic this year as it had been in previous years. Like it's not, I think more than anything, it was just that those guys couldn't find a way to work together and like support each other in an environment that was conducive to team success. And, you know, that's something this organization needs to, I think, take a long, hard look at, figure out exactly what happened, and then figure out, can you really partner with Pedersen and can you be the team that gets the bounce back
yes.
next year?
Can you create whatever Washington did with Pierre-Luc Dubois to get the bounce back? Can you create it here without the change of scenery?
I mean, Washington also got it from Chikrin and also from Logan Thompson. So
they're doing something there.
They might have something in the water.
Can't find the latest episodes of your favorite HGTV, Discovery, and Food Network shows? Rogers Xfinity TV has the newest seasons of the top-rated shows on these popular channels, while other providers are no longer including them in their TV lineup. If your TV provider doesn't carry these channels, you're missing out on new seasons of Celebrity IOU, Hometown Beat Bobby Flay, Expedition X, and more. Don't be fooled by other channels pretending to be these networks you know and love. Get the latest with Rogers Xfinity TV at Rogers.com. That's all for us. We're back tomorrow for more classical music and more Canucks talk on Sportsnet 650.